friends, welcome back to Not Again, the podcast that brings college-level analysis to preschool-level content. I'm one of your hosts, Rebecca, and with me again today, instead of my regular co-host and regular husband, is my substitute co-host and substitute husband. Yeah,
I
guess.
I think Heather may have a thing or two to say about that. Yeah.
Is my substitute co-host and Heather Sinclair's partner, Martin.
Hello.
Welcome back to the podcast, Martin.
My throat's a little scratchy today, so I apologize in advance.
Yeah, I know. I also know that, like, I'm not in my usual recording space, and I'm trying my best, folks, as far as, like, background noise and echoes and whatever, but let's face it, you're spoiled by all these podcasts out there that have, like, perfect production value.
Look, those guys, they have, like, professional recording studios, expensive mics. We just have a little Blue Yeti in a bedroom,
exactly.
And we're making do with that.
Exactly. So, right off the bat, we have to go back and kind of do, I guess, like, a correction or a caveat or something about our last episode. We were getting very up in arms about Remy washing his hands with a droplet of water and then getting sewage all over the food. I forgot, as I always forget, that the first thing that happens when Remy falls in... Oh, we're talking about Ratatouille today. If you didn't hear that I'm just getting right into it. For once, I jumped right into it, and I shouldn't have. Oh, no.
Like, they're all fans by this point, right? Like, yeah. Whose first episode is this one?
If this is your first episode, I would recommend, like, maybe episode 8 or 9 or the Frozen episodes, whatever those ones are.
Or at least go back to listen to part one of this one.
Yes, part one of this one, last episode. We're talking about Ratatouille. Spoilers again for Ratatouille. So when Remy first drops into the restaurant, falls in, he lands in a sink of soapy water that was used for washing dishes. And I always associated that with, like, that's how he has a soft landing. Like, that's how they worked it out so that he could fall into a restaurant without just being a little rat splatter on the floor. And so I never considered that it would serve two purposes. One being no rat splatter on the floor. And two being it washes him because he's in soapy water.
So that still raises the question, though, why did they draw attention to the fact he washes his hands?
Exactly. So he goes hither and thither all over the restaurant, because the first few times I saw it, there's this moment where he jumps into a roast pan with two ducks and, like, a bunch of carrots and stuff, and I'm just like, oh, God, someone's gonna, you know, like, I didn't realize that he'd been, quote, washed off, and I don't know how much washing my rat needs before I'm willing to put it in my roast, but, like, if it's been in the sewer, I don't know if I'll ever be comfortable with
that. I guess
that.
A lot more than that,
yeah.
But it is a cartoon, so for the sake of for the sake of understanding the cartoon logic.
Is dish soap sewer quality? I don't know. They should have a Dawn commercial. Like, we clean oil spills off of ducks and sewage off of rats. That's how good Dawn is. This podcast is not particularly promoted by Dawn or supported by Dawn, just so you know.
I've never even used Dawn. We don't have it in Scotland.
I used to use it, but I've switched. But I'm not going to say who I switched to, because I'm not going to give them free advertising.
They have to come to us and pay for that privilege.
for the dish so bad. So he is slightly cleaner than I guess we realized, but that does beg the question, why did he then choose to wash his hands with a droplet of water? Mm-hmm. And I guess it's just character development, right? We have to know that he's conscientious.
He takes kitchen work seriously. Yeah.
Right. So, good Lord, we did not get through a lot.
No, well, we talked a lot at length about some stuff that was not in the notes. In fairness.
Well, that's usually how it goes, but oh my goodness. I believe that we stopped at the discovery of pulling on the hair.
Yes.
To operate the body. We went past one can become too familiar with vegetables, onto he's under his hat now, and then he almost gets run over by a waiter, and Remy pulls out his hair and helps him avoid it, and then they go into the bathroom and just discover that Linguini, at least, in this world, maybe everybody, they never explore this, has nerve endings and tendons connected to his hair. And bypasses his brain. It goes around the brain into his muscles of his arms and legs and body. And they're like, that sounds great. We'll use this for cooking. So that happens. I said this last time, I don't know about believing that. Like, it's a cartoon and
it doesn't have to make sense in a logical way. Because you kind of understand that it's not literal. It's a metaphor. But at the same time, for me, on top of everything else that we've seen, it's just a little too much.
Yeah.
Because we have this idea, we've already established all these different ideas here about, you know, this being like a film about like cooking and kitchen and they're, yeah, sure, there's like talking rats and they have their own little society, but it's a fairly relatable, grounded world, really, because the rats live the way you'd expect rats to live and the people live the way you'd expect people to live. And so far, nothing has until this point been that cartoonish.
Except for the rats being sentient and having a society and all that. But that's typical cartoon fare.
Yeah, but from like a logical perspective, that still feels pretty grounded.
Yeah.
Because the rats, from a human perspective, in the fiction of the story, are just rats.
Yeah.
So, like, we understand that there's... We've established ground rules, essentially, for how we are supposed to interpret the world. And then they introduce this really out there concept, just out of nowhere, about 15, 20 minutes in.
Yeah.
And by that point, we're really supposed to be done with, like, establishing themes and ideas for the film, for a film like this. And to then just drop that in is a bit much.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, and by the way, he's going to puppet him with his hair. But I do like the montage that comes after. I like that, you know, because the cartoon logic can say, like, and he instantly knew how to use it. You know, like, how to do this thing. But they had a montage of them learning how to work together.
It's quite fun. I like this scene.
And yeah, I mean, obviously I laughed very, very hard when the window broke and he like tries to remove his blindfold and Remy just slowly pushes it back down, like that kind of thing. And the frustration of trying to get spaghetti out of a box. Who doesn't know that frustration? Everybody has struggled with this blanket statement. So I like the montage. I think it's well done. I think it shows well that they had to kind of learn how to work this out, and so I like that it wasn't instantaneous. That's all I had to say about that. Positive stuff we move on from.
I think that's a pretty good scene. I like that scene.
So the next thing that I have in my notes, this one's going to take a while, is that Colette should be the protagonist. Okay, so what happens is Linguini and Remy recreate this magical soup that is spicy yet subtle, according to Celine the Eclair. I assume she's just an eclair.
Yeah, she's like a sentient eclair.
Sentient eclair, yeah. thank you. That's our word. I forgot. Hey, everybody. It's sentient. It's back. Play the music. I learned very quickly that when you're reviewing children's movies and TV shows, the word sentient comes up a lot.
Yep.
Another
useful word is sapient.
Yes, sapient. Yeah, sapient for animals, I guess, yeah. I always just say sentient as a catch-all term, but that's because I'm very dumb. Anyway, Colette, she is given the responsibility of training Linguini to work in the kitchen. Skinner's like, okay, well, you know how to make this soup, but you need to know more, so Colette's going to teach you. And he swaggers up to her and is like, well, hello, I just want to say. And then she, you know, uses three knives to pin him to a cutting board and goes on a very accurate rant about how she's the only woman in this kitchen and she had to work extra hard to get there because, I can't say the word in French, it's haute cuisine, there we go, is so, built
again, on... excuse my French, my back.
Yeah, I don't know, it's hot cuisine, I'm just going to call it hot cuisine. They don't cook anything cold there, they don't prepare salads. Hot cuisine is based on an antiquated hierarchy built by stupid old men. She does this whole rant, this whole correct rant that applies to many places in the world, not just, you know, industries, I mean, but like definitely cooking, right? It's a man's game. Women are meant to be kept down and she's had to fight for her position. And then they just move on. They're like, okay, well, bye.
Yeah, I think there's two things I wanted to say about this scene. And I think one of them is obvious. Is they just move on from that and never really address it again.
Yeah. She had her piece, right? Yeah, she had her feminist piece, and now she's done. She's had her
bit, and now we all just move on with our lives, and ultimately nothing changes.
Which is exactly, like, yeah. I swear, it's like a microcosm of exactly what she was saying. Like, women are pushed out and ignored, and then she's immediately sidelined by the movie.
But I think also what we have here is an example of what you could call controlled opposition, right? So you have a character who is introduced in the film explicitly for the purpose of saying this, so that it gets out in front of criticism of the film.
Yep.
Which the film is then just going to ignore. Because what you have is a character who says women are treated badly in this particular way in haute cuisine, and then moving on, and then not acknowledging the fact that she's still also the only woman in this film.
Yes. Not even female rats. I pointed this out before. I think there might be one in the very end who says, how do you know? And that's the only female rat I've noticed in this movie.
She's the only named woman with lines in the entire film.
It so very badly does not pass the Bechdel test. It does not even get past step one.
Nope.
Oh, no, Celine Leclerc. She's a named character, and she says, waiter.
But she's not actually a character.
But yeah, that's, she's I wouldn't even call that a named character. Yeah. So, yes. So there's that. And then also, just like exploring this, I would want Colette to be the protagonist. Imagine a movie where a woman is struggling to get by in a man's world, and she meets, hey, maybe even a female rat. I don't know. Whatever. It doesn't really matter. I don't care about rat feminism. And the rat helps her to work her way up, and they struggle not with like cooking, like they got that part down, but with the system. And you have a female protagonist that isn't just a princess, action princess, no want Mary, go listen to our Brave episodes. And you have actual societal commentary as opposed to another white man who gets everything he ever wanted without much effort. You know, like, I think it would have been such a more dynamic story and they could have played with that a lot more.
You've also got a way more interesting conflict here in that you have two people who are both good cooks. And what you maybe have is more learning about confidence. So you have someone who has had to work really, really hard to get to a level, like a high level in this environment, who is then introduced to another outsider who is not allowed in this environment at all. And this person then teaches her to be more confident and original ideas. Because that's one of the themes in the film, is that it goes through, stop, you know, slavishly obeying the old recipes and try something new. And that's essentially the meant to be the lesson you get from the film, right? We talked about this a lot before. It's about, the stated lesson of the film is it's about being open to new ideas.
You know what? That sounds good, but I'm going to need you to say the actual intro to it, which is, I found a lesson.
I found a lesson. And the lesson was being open to new ideas. being open-minded and willing to, the way the film states it is a little obnoxious, but you could boil it down to be open-minded to new things.
Yeah, be open-minded.
And that is a much more interesting dynamic when placed next to Colette than Linguini, who has no investment in the world of French restaurant, red French cooking at all.
Yeah.
He knows nothing about it. He walks in knowing nothing. Unable to do anything.
He's basically passionate about roller skating.
Ends it still unable to do anything, and having learned nothing.
Right, except that maybe he should trust his rat friend more. I'm not even sure about that. We'll get there. I mean, eventually we'll have to be at the ending of the movie, and we'll have to decide, like, where are we now? Like, are we better off than when we started? So to have that, and then, of course, she's just love interest, McGee. Like, that's what you become. And it's so insulting to hang a lampshade on it. That, like, there's feminism issues, or lack thereof, and then to be like, and now back to the sidelines with you, Colette.
As soon as she becomes a love interest as well, like, her character just disappears from the film.
Yeah, well...
She's only in the background and never contributes anything to the plot after that point.
To jump ahead a little bit, when Skinner wants to find out about the rat and get Linguini drunk and whatever in his office, and Colette misinterprets that as, like, the chef wants to have, like, a private chat with him to discuss his future or whatever... Horst, the German sous chef, says, the plongeur doesn't need you anymore, Colette. He's gotten all he needs. And he's teasing her. He's taunting her with this, that he has basically used her as a boost up in his career. But he's just right, regardless of the fact that in that moment, she's misinterpreted, really? I've had too much coffee today, folks. She's misinterpreted that particular interaction, but overall, he is still right. He has gained success on her back, on her teaching, and does not need her anymore. And the movie confirms this because she is relegated to love interest.
Ultimately, it doesn't matter whether Linguini does this intentionally or not. Like, if it's unintentional, it's still the effect of what happens.
Yes.
So you have a situation where he is still benefiting from her from her teaching, from her hard work, helping him kind of navigate the kitchen better to more convincingly sell what he's doing. And her reward for that is nothing.
She gets to work at a different restaurant under a rat chef now.
It's actually not, we'll not get really to that by the end. It's not super clear whether people know about that.
So our next point is about frozen food being evil. So just to set the scene, we go into the office where Chef Skinner is talking to Francois, who is his, I guess, like...
Lawyer?
Designer? No, the lawyer's the snooty guy. I don't even know if he gets a name. Francois, the man who, like, draws the Gusto mascots or whatever.
I was confused by that.
And we are meant to believe that this is some evil thing he's doing, trying to keep the brand and the restaurant afloat by selling frozen food. But I wrote that the only really evil thing in this scene is stereotypes. Like, I'm not sure I'm against frozen food. Like, whatever. Well, we can address that if we want. But every single image in that room is stereotypes, and they seem more appalled by the frozen food concept than the fact that he has, like, a Chinese version of Gusto.
A Mexican version of Gusto.
Yeah. People should be like, look, you can make your frozen food or whatever, but this has got to... I think even Trader Joe's got in trouble for making, like, Trader Giuseppe and Trader Jose. Yeah. Like, that felt way more harmless than what Skinner is doing.
Yeah.
Not to say it is harmless, obviously, stereotyping in general and whatever, making fun of people's names, very bad. But I'm just saying, like, they probably should have been like, look, if you're going to continue this frozen food stuff, could you... not with this, you know, like, so I just, like, yeah, and we could go on for a long time and probably will about the fact that maybe the villain isn't so much of a villain. Like, is he a jerk? Yes. Is he doing everything he can to keep this restaurant alive so that people can still have their jobs? Yes. It doesn't, I think it's supposed to be framed as he's so greedy that he's made these frozen foods, or he doesn't care about the Gusto message or whatever it is. But it really just looks like he's trying to keep everybody in jobs.
I think you can read it as an attempt at the Brad Bird issue, where I think we mentioned this before in the last episode too. Like, his whole thing is that he worships genius, the idea that there are individual great people who deserve to be recognized, and if you're not doing that, you're some kind of, like, moral failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, like, mediocrity keeps great people down and prevents them from really achieving things that would benefit all of society. Because they view him as someone who is not of the, I guess a way to put it is the genius class.
Yeah.
Or someone who's not, like, uniquely amazing and contributing great things to the world. So he is being morally punished because he's preventing true geniuses from getting through. And so when you talked earlier about how he's just trying to keep the restaurant afloat, in the moral logic of this world, that's a bad thing.
Yeah. You shouldn't want to, like, financially get... I mean, so here's the thing. They wanted it to be his greed, but they didn't really... Like, he said their reputation was dangling by a thread. So they only focus on how he's trying to save their reputation, which is portrayed as a bad thing, but honestly, if they want to keep their jobs, it's not. So if they wanted to make it more about his greed, they should have hammered that home a little more, that he was, like, that the frozen foods were not necessary, that he wanted to capitalize on the Gusto name to make money, and he didn't care what happened to the restaurant. But he seemed to genuinely want to keep working at the restaurant, too.
Well, we're supposed to look at the frozen foods thing as, like, an inherently bad thing, regardless of his motivations, because frozen food has a reputation for being mediocre. And he should be too proud to do that, because that's what a genius would do.
And I can say that he cares somewhat about working at the restaurant because he keeps accidentally calling it his restaurant, or he does it at least once. Like, when he calls the health inspector, he says, the rats have taken over my restaurant. I mean, Gusto's. So, like, he still sees it as his restaurant. There's some possessiveness in there.
Yeah.
Whether it's the job, the acclaim, the fate, you know, whatever it may be, but it's something. And they could have pushed a little harder for, like, he only cares about financial gain and maybe even, like, doesn't even care about status, which is something that isn't usually portrayed as a good thing, to care about status. But, like, for this restaurant, they seem to, because it, like, lost stars, and that's a bad thing or whatever. Yeah. And the reviews.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the logic of the film, he is, his crime is that he isn't allowing new ideas to come out.
Right.
So he's just slavishly sticking to what they know worked when Gusto was alive.
Yeah.
Because he's afraid to try new ideas, and that's because he's afraid of the reputation, the problem. Because Gusto died after they lost one of their stars, and it is implied that that was why he died.
Yeah, the heartbroken chef died soon after. Yeah. Like.
So, like, I mean, what's... The loss of the second star, I think, is what ultimately you're meant to read that as. That is Chef Skinner deciding that they can't take risks anymore.
Yeah, I mean, three stars is...
Yeah, so they have to stick with what they know works, and in doing so, they are able to keep themselves going, even if they're never able to excel. And the logic of a Brad Bird movie, and the logic of this kind of worldview, that's worse than just failing.
Right.
Because you're never going to be amazing. You'll just be okay. And that's the worst thing you can possibly be.
Yes, how dare you want to just survive? Like, how dare you want to keep jobs and whatever? Like, you should be innovating at every opportunity and letting rats cook for you and such. Yeah.
And it's not that, you know, Skinner isn't a bad guy in some other ways. It's just that they clearly want us to vilify him for things that aren't really very fair.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't ask to be put in certain situations, and I think that... Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't go to say, like, he's the most sympathetic villain that has ever been created or whatever. Like, I mean, Ursula's got more of a gripe, you know what I mean? But, like, but still, there are some things that are portrayed as villainous that are really just, like, capitalist. And, like, I think capitalism is evil, but, like, not... The creators of this film don't, because they make their money from capitalism. So it's weird that they're like,
And the heroes of the film still engage in that. So how are we supposed to read it?
And like I said, the reviews are what matter. The reviews are what drive the plot. Ego and LeClaire and whatever. And the reviews lead to status and, you know, more people coming to your restaurant. So it is about kind of what people think of you. And that's supposed to be, like, something that they want. I don't know. It's weird. We have enough points for a third episode, so that's fun. I'm looking... I just have written down so much. I mean, I've seen this movie again and again, and I do not want to see it again for a while. So I guess it's a good thing that I'm far away from the TV where Warren will demand to watch Mousy again. But my next point is about Renata. So Renata is Linguini's deceased mother. Mm-hmm. She leaves a letter for Skinner telling him all. Gusto is Linguini's father... And I never told Linguini, and I don't want you to tell him either. And I never told Gusto. And I guess, so this is one of the things that I wanted to pick apart is what is her secret? Why keep the father of the child a secret? Especially from the father.
One of the things that got me is, like, I think I maybe misread this the first time I watched it. Because my first thought was, does she not know that Gusto is dead? And she thinks she's sending him... to be with Gusto, not realizing that he's dead.
Except that, isn't the letter addressed to Skinner?
I think it is.
Yeah, it is. I remember seeing it on the novel.
I think I misread this.
Yeah, so that would actually make sense if she thought that he was alive and she was sending her son to work with his father, unbeknownst to both of them. But it still doesn't really get to the origin of, like, why was she keeping the lineage of this child, the father of this child's secret from everyone? Like, what is the shame there? What is... Like, did Gusto not want it to get out that he had a child? How would that affect a chef's life?
Yeah, that's not really clear. And, there are a few reasons you could think of why she would send him here in specific. You know, it's like it's Gusto's former restaurant. He figured maybe someone who was so close with Gusto would be sympathetic. It's not really clear why she sent him there to be a plongeur.
Yeah.
When he could get that job literally anywhere.
Well, she just said, like, get my son a job, technically. I mean, like,
but
I don't...
she must have known he wasn't qualified
for
anything.
Yeah, she knows he's not a chef, so it's like, all he's gonna be able to do is, like, maybe, you know, like, stir some stuff for people, or, be a plunger.
He's not qualified for anything, so he would only be able to get jobs he could get anywhere.
Yeah. And how wonderful that your dead mom is like, I'm so desperate for my son to have a job, please. You know, it's like... Yeah, it's just, like... Even if it were a one-time affair, I mean, maybe that's it. Like, she had a romantic night with Gusto. She got pregnant from it, but she didn't want him involved or something. Like, she didn't want to become more entangled or something like that.
Yeah.
I could see that, but why not? He seems reliable. He's a good dude. He's got a cookbook. He's got a restaurant.
We never actually know anything about Gusto as a person because he's dead by the time the film starts.
I suppose.
And your only exposure to him as a character is his reputation and through Remy's conscience, which is not actually Gusto. It's just representative.
He could be an awful person.
But, I mean, he might have been great. But we don't know any of that.
Yeah.
So it's we can only really speculate as to what kind of person, what the reasons may have been.
Chefs never see their families anyway, so even if she did, like, you know, get married to him, she'd still live her own life. She'd never see him.
Yeah, I'm just... It's very odd. It's just a strange setup, and I get what they're going for. They needed a reason for the inheritance to be a secret.
Yeah.
I just feel... It does feel like they hadn't really thought through the logic of it.
Yeah, and I am. Yeah. I'm thinking through it, because I've been given a lot of time to do so.
Yeah.
So that's... Yeah, so Renata's dead now. Good for her. I assume that she lived a full life. And so I wrote that... So we already kind of talked about this, but I wrote that Skinner doesn't favor Linguini, the movie does. And I just... Mm-hmm. I like that idea, but we kind of already explored that. It's just like, the movie is confirming Colette's fears, yeah. but calling her an idiot for having those fears.
Yeah.
That, you know, Linguini is using her and rising above her because, you know, he's a man
yeah.
and has connections. I wrote, there sure are a lot of Americans in France. Oh, because, I mean, not that there, I mean, yes, no, people, yeah, there are, people yeah. visit Paris, but like, Linguini has an American accent and Remy, well, Remy's not anything, I suppose.
Every he's just, rat. He's a rat. Every rat in the movie has yeah, an American accent.
Yes, they do. But then when they go, so here's the thing, is when they go to take the order of the pretentious people who say like, we have your soup every time and we want something new, they're American. So like, they aren't tourists there for a quick meal. They come there a lot and apparently have this brand new soup, quote, every time. They've been here a lot. They have a lot of money to throw away, I guess. And so, yeah, they're American. It's like, I guess they just didn't feel like having anyone do a French accent or hiring French people.
The only French actors, the only French accents that any of the actors use are for Colette, kind of.
Yeah, Colette and Skinner.
And a few side characters.
I'm trying to think.
I think a couple of the kitchen.
Do they get? They get Brad Garrett. By the way, Brad Garrett plays Gusteau. What? Okay. Anyway, did they get Brad Garrett to do a French accent for Gusteau?
I think so.
Ah, but yes. Zesty's no match for wishful thinking. Yes. Okay. Sorry, I had to play it in my head. But yeah. So sort of. It's just kind of funny. It's just like, oh my god, like totally. Welcome to France. It's just like, okay.
You're gonna love Paris.
Look, I don't need to eat your foie gras or whatever. Like, okay, great. Could you have some French people eating at this restaurant? No? Okay. Anyway, Skinner becomes Crocker from Fairly Odd Parents. Oh, this is a deep cut. How many people know Fairly Odd Parents anymore?
Oh, yeah.
So once upon a time, there was a TV show, fairly decent, on Nickelodeon called The Fairly Odd Parents, and there was a teacher that Timmy Turner had who was obsessed with fairy godparents, and every time he said fairy godparents, he spazzed out a bit about it. And I guess we were drawing some parallels between Skinner's reaction to rats and...
Yeah. Well, he does this thing where he keeps... set up that he sees the rat...
Everywhere, yeah.
Silhouetted in the hat at one point and a couple of other times. And is trying to prove something. Not clear what. Because it's really not very clear why he's drawing a connection between what Linguini is doing and the rat existing... Because he only knows the rat exists, but like,
he hasn't guessed
what the rat's role in it, what Remy's role in this actually
yeah,
is.
Just hold on for one second, because that ties into my next point, so yeah. Let's explore this. So my next point is Gusteau telling Linguini, the boy could lose his job, because Gusteau was telling Remy. Remy goes in, his brother and his friends are like, give us people food or whatever. And Remy goes into Gusteau's office to get the key to unlock the fridge. The walk-in, whatever.
Yeah.
And his conscience, Gusteau, is like, what are you doing? And he's like, my family's here for food. And he's like, but you're stealing. And he's like, because again, that moral message that they hammer home, you can't steal. And he's like, well, you know, I need to keep them quiet because if I don't, then bad things or whatever. And he says, the boy, in brackets, Linguini, could lose his job. How? Why? It's not like anyone's going to be like, hey, food's missing. Linguini, you're fired. Like, nobody associates this rat with him yet. And so, and he would also have to be caught for that to happen. So, like, the worst case scenario, he gets caught by someone who's not Linguini stealing food. They're just going to be like, ah. A rat. They might question how the rat's using a key to unlock the walk-in, but hey, you know what?
Yeah, there's no logical way they could tie that to Linguini, though.
Yeah.
And Linguini is not the guy responsible for dealing with the rats in the restaurant either, so it's not that.
Yeah, it's not like...
just a dishwasher, basically.
They're not going to think that he's... So the movie kind of forgets that while the audience is associating the rat with Linguini...
Because we know the reason.
It's called dramatic irony. The characters have no idea, you know, it's like... So Skinner is like, we need to find this rat. Why? So that you can fire him for bringing pest into the restaurant?
Or? Yeah, so like...
He's so desperate to.
What you might argue is that he wants to find the rat so he has an excuse to fire Linguini.
Mm-hmm.
But that is never really articulated. It doesn't always make sense.
There's a slight hint at some paranoia on Skinner's part when he's talking to his snooty lawyer who's drinking from the teeny tiny espresso cup. He says, the boy knows too much, like, you know, I think it's implied he wants to fire him so that he doesn't find out about the will or something. But again, there's not a huge connection. Because, like, look at the interrogation, right? The rat interrogation in the office with the bottle of wine. He is desperate to find out Linguini's connection to this rat.
Yeah.
Like, Linguini admitting that he has a rat, but that the rat isn't there right now, is not enough to fire. I don't know what France's legal stuff is for firing employees or whatever. I mean, it's terrible in some states where they're just like, eh, I can fire you. I don't really need a reason. So, yeah. So but why is he so desperate to know about this rat in a context when it won't help him fire Linguini?
I think it's such a weird, as you said, it's a weird, like, misapplication of dramatic irony because we know the reason. There's no logical way that Skinner could know the reason.
I mean, he's definitely upset that he feels like Linguini's messing with him because he tells the lawyer, like, he's playing this game with me where I think I see the rat and then it's not there. Right. He's gaslighting me, essentially.
Is it possible we're supposed to read it like Skinner thinks that Linguini's doing this just to, like, mess with his head. Sorry, no, I said a swear.
That's okay. I will bleep the swear with something hilarious.
Just to kind of mess with his head a bit, to try to, like, make him paranoid. And he believes, at this point in the film, that Linguini knows about the restaurant, knows that he's inherited it, and is trying to ruin Skinner to take over or something like that. It's not really very clear.
His paranoia thing so quickly. It's basically one scene where he's, like, yelling at his lawyer, and then his lawyer's like, calm down, keep an eye on him, and I'll look into this, right? And it's like, okay. And I think he was looking into the rat thing even before he knew about the will, but I'm not sure about that. I'd have to rewatch the movie, and God knows I'm not going to do that.
Well,
so.
there's a scene where his lawyer takes a sample of hair so he can try and verify the ancestor, like, Linguini's ancestry, and it comes back a later scene, and it's like, oh, we found rodent hair.
Yeah.
And it's meant to be Skinner going, the thing I suspected for some reason be true.
You'd think the lawyer would pay a little more attention to that, where he's like, I see a rat everywhere. Oh, well, speaking of that. And by the way, running DNA scans isn't going to change anything. I mean, like, the implication is that they'll use a different hair or something like that, but, like, it's just kind of funny. Like, we reran it and came back as human. You know, these machines, they're not always accurate. Sometimes they just say you have rat DNA. It's like, what? Reads that letter fairly early in the film. I think I can say that maybe he starts acting paranoid about the rat after he finds out that the restaurant is supposed to go to Linguini. I'm not going to say
it's still, that. Again, doesn't
but
make
still,
much
it's
sense.
Still
there's
weird,
a connection. He draws a connection there.
Yeah. I'll say at least there's a possibility that he doesn't care about it until after he reads the will or whatever, or the letter.
That makes sense.
All right. Well, we're almost done with part two. Let's just do one or two more points here. We already talked in the last episode about how his dad takes him to, like, a rat death shop.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
He's like, hold on, Remy, I think I need to show you something.
Here's a window full of corpses.
Here's a window full of corpses of your brethren. And Remy's like, oh, I can't look at this. And he's like, well, but what point are you trying to prove? Like, he knows that. Remember when a woman took a shotgun and tried to, like, he knows humans want to kill him. That's why he didn't waltz into the restaurant and be like, hey, everybody, I can cook. He's using, you know, so.
And it completely contradicts an earlier application of the same idea where his dad tried to argue they shouldn't take food from the house because humans are dangerous.
Right.
So we then follow this up with a plan for his dad to steal everything from the kitchen pantry.
And that comes later, but that's why we drilled into it. So we're almost done with points here. So let me see. The last one we'll talk about then is just a scene I terribly, terribly hate. So Skinner keeps Linguini up all night and drunk, I guess.
Yeah.
And then makes him clean up the restaurant. And Linguini stays all night and does that. And when Remy comes into the restaurant in the morning, he finds Linguini passed out on the floor, sleeping, after having cleaned the restaurant. And he is absolutely terrified, for some reason, that someone will see him. This leads to some comic shenanigans where we find out that he can puppet Linguini's body when Linguini is not conscious.
Which is terrifying.
Which is, yeah. This could easily be a horror movie. And so he, like, insists on picking him up using his hair and making him look awake and busy. But he's not on the, like, there's no, even if Skinner were to walk in, like, there's no consequence for if he gets caught sleeping on the restaurant floor.
Yeah.
Like, I know he's worried
he's
about
not gonna
losing
lose his
the job
at this point. Well, at this point, though, his reputation in this kitchen is already well established.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense that he would be fired for that when everyone already knows that he was in the office drinking with Skinner the night before.
During off hour, like, here's what happens, okay? The scenario is this. He's asleep on the floor, Colette walks in, any of the other workers walk in, really. They see him asleep on the floor, and they wake him up, and they go, hey, what happened, man? And he goes, oh, sorry, I was up all night cleaning. The chef made me clean. And they were like, they'd be like, eh, that's rough. All right, I'm going to prep some lemon zest over here or whatever. Okay. You know, like,
chop some garlic.
Yeah, do you need some coffee? You know, it's like, there would be nothing. It wouldn't be a problem at all, especially since he's not really on the clock, you know? And so it's just his absolute desperation to get Linguini up makes no sense to me at all. And in fact, it would have prevented the next scene where Colette is like, I hate you, blah, 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 blah. Because, you know, she would have found him and he would have been like, what? No, the chef kept me up talking all night about nothing. And then he made me clean the entire kitchen and that sucks. And she might have been like, oh, I thought he was taking you in there to take you under his wing, and it turns out I was wrong. Like, it would have been better.
So often the case in these stories, if people just talked to each other, the problem would be solved immediately.
Oh, God, I know. I'm getting more and more frustrated by this as I get older. In my old age of 30, I'm just, like, watching these, especially Hallmark movies. So, Martin and their partner, Heather Sinclair, my best friend, they watch bad movies. We watch bad movies together as, like, as a fun time activity.
Yeah.
And Hallmark movies are the worst for, like, adults who won't just talk to each other like adults. They won't just be like, hey, I saw you the other day doing something that made me feel uncomfortable. Can you explain that to me? They just go, I have to drive back home to Texas. I can't believe that he betrayed me that one time I saw him in that supermarket talking to another woman. It's like, you know, it's just like that. Adults... It's childish to not talk, to give the cold shoulder, to go behind people's backs and try to find, adults just like converse when they're acting like adults.
And it's not like there aren't adults that do that, but yes. It's not like normal behavior.
I would call it childish behavior is what I'm saying in that adult who does. Anyway, so that's where we'll leave it is Remy is puppeting Linguini's unconscious form for hilarious hijinks.
Yep.
And this will lead to a lovely transition for the very beginning of our next episode.
Oh, that's going to be a fun place to start. Get some good energy there.
Yeah. We're going to start out on a really high note. Or just uncomfortable. I meant to say uncomfortable. Sorry. We're going to start out on a really uncomfortable note next episode. So look forward to that.
That's going
to
be fun.
Until then... I have forgotten to say this, like, for, what is this, 40 episodes now, probably. Thank you to my husband, who's not here, Alan, my regular co-host and regular husband, for composing the music for our show, the Not Again theme that plays at the beginning and ending of this show. He made that on his piano. And I feel like I should credit him every once in a while, and I never do. So... that happened. I'm at Glass School, so you can donate to a GoFundMe and get some glass. And I have a book out. It's a young adult supernatural romance. It's called Hellbound. And we have support sites and a Patreon. We haven't updated our Patreon recently, but that's more because we're not in the same place and we can barely create regular episodes. Not that I don't love having you here, Martin, but, you know. So, you know, but we do have a Patreon and other stuff as well. You can find all that in the description of the episode and on my website and on my Twitter. I actually like to direct people to my Twitter because it's really nice to just find all the links that are like associated with me in any way, shape, or form.
You've got a link tree there, haven't you?
Yeah, I have a link tree and just a picture of all like the pin thread on my profile at Bex Goose will tell all. So anyway, where can people find you on social media?
Well, best place is probably Twitter at isthismartin. That's isthismartyn. I also have a couple of projects that are in the works right now. They've been kind of on hiatus for a little while because of some work and kind of immigration related situations. Nothing bad, fortunately, but like it does take up a lot of my time and energy right now, so I've not had the time I need to work on some of these projects, but they are still ongoing, including The Haven, where 10 episodes of the first season of The Haven are still available. It is a actual play D&D podcast with me and a few friends who have collaborated together on the story. The next season will no longer be a D&D podcast. It'll just be a fiction, audio drama.
You have audio drama.
Set in the same, I'm very excited. With the same setting and some of the same characters. It's going to be continuing the story from that point on. I'm also working on a new podcast, which has gone a little bit delayed because of, again, my own, some personal issues and some other members of the cast, working on The Family Business, which is our podcast about Supernatural, where we're rewatching every episode from the beginning. And that's going to take a long time.
It sure is.
So,
and you promised to have me on.
Yes, some point, absolutely. I'm going to let you pick which episode you want it to be on.
Yes, so I am very excited about that. All right, so that was fun. And now I am wrapping up part 2 of 3 of our Ratatouille chat. Martin will be back one more time next week. We are releasing on Mondays because it's a little bit easier just with the current schedule and the way things are going. So look for our next episode next Monday until I'm back at home in December. That's probably how it's going to be. And until then, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for existing. And thank you for helping us to maintain our marbles for just one more week. And we will catch you next time. Until then, I'm Rebecca.
I'm Martin.
Bye, friends.
Bye.